From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, another John Doe investigation is reportedly underway in Wisconsin. We'll get more from the Journal Sentinel's Dan Bice. Then, in the brave new world of healthcare reform, a new world of conflict, too.
Many times the systems are designed or rules are promulgated without understanding specifically how they're going to affect people at the front line.
Milwaukee Magazine editor Kurt Chandler takes a minute to learn about the man living in a car near the library.
I have a nice car. I went home that day after talking to him, and I had a nice lunch and live in a comfortable home, and it was miles away from his existence.
And an update on a Shorewood Woman's Legacy Letters project. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. A secretive John Doe investigation has reportedly been opened into a variety of allegations involving state government. The Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel's Dan Bice broke the story yesterday, citing several sources reportedly familiar with the probe. The news comes 7 months after the closure of another John Doe investigation that resulted in six people, including three aides to Scott Walker, being convicted of criminal charges. Dan Bice is a reporter who writes the No Quarter blog at the Journal Sentinel, and he's with us in the studio to tell us more. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a timeline issue, if we could. I'm tempted to refer to this as a new John Doe investigation, but you report it's actually been open for some time, right?
It has. Some people are calling it Son of Doe, but I'm referring to it as John Doe too. But yeah, very few people knew that actually during the recall elections, there were two John Doe investigations going on. But it appears that there's a lot of activity going on in the past month with this one, and I think that's why it's getting so much attention. But you're right. This one was initiated in February of 2012, and the first John Doe 1, was started in May of 2010 and ran until March of this year.
Well, and so what have you learned about the scope of John Doe 2, if you will, where it's taking place and the nature of the issues being looked at?
It was initiated by prosecutors in Milwaukee County. They turned up a number of issues in John Doe 1 that they didn't want to deal with there. And there also have been issues raised about the recall election. So it started in Milwaukee County, but it's now spread to at least five other counties. Much of the activity right now it's taking place in Dane County. And as it spread and became a larger investigation, they brought on a special prosecutor to help them with this case.
Well, and you said initially it was ongoing in Milwaukee County,
right.
And could it have been wrapped up in the first John Doe investigation?
You know, the first John Doe investigation focused primarily on staffers to Scott Walker when he was Milwaukee County executive. As I understand it, everything in this investigation comes and has to do with events that took place after the 2010 election. So there's a definite distinction in their minds between the two. So I think everything that they investigated in John Doe 1, they dealt with, closed it in March, and now they're on to other issues. And, you know, the thing is with John Doe investigations, and these are like federal grand juries where they can collect evidence in secret, they can compel testimony in secret, and they can do search warrants in secret. And the thing is that, you know, with this new one, they're focusing on things that have taken place since the 2010 election.
What can you tell us about who is leading this particular investigation and the judge that's overseeing it?
The judges in Milwaukee County, they've been relying on two different judges, Judge Nettesheim, who oversaw John Doe 1, and right now it's Judge Kluka, who is a former Kenosha County judge. And the special prosecutor is a guy named Fran Schmitz, who was an assistant U.S. attorney here for a long time, almost 30 years. He was a finalist in 2001 to be the U.S. attorney, along with Steve Biskupic. And George Bush eventually nominated Biskupic, so he was the runner-up for that position. He's someone who's got impeccable credentials. I've never heard very many people – actually, I don't think I've heard anyone criticize him. He's very much a straight shooter. And, you know, this is probably an attempt to avoid the criticism that came in the John Doe 1, where John Chisholm, the DA in Milwaukee County, is a Democrat, and he's investigating a Republican governor. In this case, I don't know Fran Schmitz's affiliations, but he was a finalist for the U.S. attorney's job under a Republican president.
Have you learned who might be under scrutiny here?
I've heard names, and I haven't run some of those names out there because I don't know the strength of the charges. And, you know, it could be a potentially damaging thing to put someone's name out there without knowing what exactly they might have against them. I did the same thing in John Doe 1 when one of Walker's aides, Kelly Reinfleisch, was about to be charged. I wrote a column saying that one of his aides would be charged tomorrow or the next day, but I decided not to do it. I would describe her in general. And I've heard that there's at least one legislative leader who's been getting a lot of scrutiny and that there's a lot of attention being paid to the governor's recall election. I can tell you, I talked with Scott Walker, Governor Scott Walker at a press event today, and one of our reporters talked to the leaders of the Assembly and the Senate to ask their reactions. And they had interesting reactions to the John Doe.
Well, and what kind of reactions have you gotten?
Well, Robin Voss, the Assembly Speaker, said he's heard rumors of the investigation, but he knew nothing about it directly. Scott Fitzgerald, who did have a recall election, declined comment, wouldn't say anything. He was asked if he's been asked to appear before the John Doe or if he's had any records seized or anything. He declined to say whether that's happened. And the governor has implied that the fact that this is coming out now is political. And I asked him directly if he, his lawyers, his campaign staff, or his state house staff had been contacted by anyone in the John Doe. And he ducked the question. He said he didn't want to be distracted by that. So I asked him if he or his attorneys had been contacted. And again, he refused to answer that question.
Have you heard from Democrats about this?
I talked to Tom Barrett's campaign, to his chief of staff. They knew nothing about this. So, but as I said, it's gone to five different counties. And so I don't know everybody, you know, that they're looking at and targeting. But, you know, these things are like black boxes. We're not sure what's actually in them until the prosecutors decide to open it up. And the things go in so many different directions. They start one place. And with John Doe 1, they start with, you know, looking at political things, and they end up bringing charges against somebody for child pornography and a number of things like that, and stealing money from a vet's fund, which no one in the public knew anything about. So who knows where these things have gone? This has been open since February of 2012, so it could have gone in a number of directions.
And to make things clear, we are not likely to know anything for certain about anything until actual charges are filed?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing because people get confused because it's a secret investigation. They say, well, you shouldn't be writing about this. And I've gotten emails like that today. How could you write this? The orders, secrecy orders, apply only to those who appeared directly before the judge or those who were, have been told not to talk. So, for instance, if your cousin has had a search warrant, you know, that they've taken out against them, you're not bound by anything. So word leaks out about some of these things. But to tell the truth, people were surprised that this John Doe hasn't been discovered until just now.
Obviously, you have not named your sources, as we would expect in the nature of reporting on something like this. But I gather there are multiple sources that have spoken with you on this.
Yeah. And to do the story for that I did for yesterday's paper, I had six people confirming the investigation, the special prosecutor and the judge who was involved. And with the people who were potential targets, I had the legislative leaders named by three different people, and the governor's race was also mentioned by three different people. So so it wasn't like, you know, I sat there, came up, was talking to a buddy and decided to go into work and do these things because my credibility is on the line with these stories. If I write this and this isn't true, and there are a lot of people who would hope that this wasn't true. So, you know, when I post these stories, I try to make sure it's not just double checked, but triple checked and quadruple checked.
Well, it seems telling. There are people that you've spoken to who have not wanted to comment, but you haven't quoted anybody as denying any of this is taking place.
No, there's no one saying this is that this isn't actually going on. The DA's office declined to talk about it. The special prosecutor I contacted multiple different ways, and I've dealt with Fran Schmitz over the years, but he chose not to respond. And you know, yeah, no one's saying that this is not going on. In fact, the main reaction has been, why did this take you so long to write about it?
Dan Bice, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Dan Bice is a watchdog reporter and writes the No Quarter blog for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He broke the story of another John Doe investigation involving possible campaign violations during the gubernatorial recall election. There is a link to that coverage from WUWM.com/lake effect. We'll take a break now and then talk about how healthcare reform is impacting the issue of dispute resolution in medicine. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The Obama administration is taking heat for early glitches in the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. It's largely as a result of problems with the website healthcare.gov. But even if and when the act is working flawlessly from a technical standpoint, many unknowns will remain as many Americans get used to different layers of accountability. Last week at Marquette University, some leaders in the field of dispute resolution gathered to talk about solving conflict in healthcare. It's a field in which Milwaukee native Leonard Marcus is a nationally recognized expert. Marcus directs the Program for Healthcare Negotiation and Conflict Resolution at the Harvard School of Public Health in Boston. He's also a leader in emergency preparedness and disaster response. More on that a little later. We met up with Leonard Marcus in the Alumni Memorial Union at Marquette. Thanks for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Why is it important to have this conversation about dispute resolution in medicine at this point in time?
Well, about every 20 or 30 years, our country gives a look to the healthcare system and decides that we want to change things. Certainly, we saw it back in the 60s with the development of Medicare and Medicaid. President Nixon later became very concerned about the rising healthcare costs, and there we saw the development of diagnostically related groups and different policies in that era. Then there was the Clinton era of health reform, and now we find that healthcare once again has gotten the attention of the country. That's because healthcare, unlike other services, is something that we pay through our tax dollars in the form of Medicare and Medicaid and subsidies, so that it becomes the kind of a policy issue in terms of fixing things that we don't see when it comes to fixing our automobiles. So healthcare right now, with the advent of the Affordable Care Act, or as it's oftentimes called, Obamacare, is on the front burner in terms of the attention both of politicians and all of those of us who get care in the system.
Do you think, I don't know that anyone could accuse this country of rushing into changes as far as healthcare goes, but do you think we go into these without necessarily giving enough thought to things like dispute resolution and conflict?
Well, many times the systems are designed or rules are promulgated without understanding specifically how they're going to affect people at the front line. And those people certainly could be patients, and there are many examples of a well-intended rule that can have patients caught up in conflict. One of them is a relatively new Medicare rule that says that hospitals won't be fully compensated for the care to a Medicare person if they're not admitted to the hospital. And one of the results, unintended consequences of this rule, is that many Medicare patients are put in a holding pattern without being admitted, and that could last for overnight. They're sent home, and they get a big bill. And they're surprised by the fact that Medicare didn't pay for it. So there's those sorts of very, very human conflicts. Within the health system, it's that old Abbott and Costello comedy routine of who's on first, what's on second, and I don't know who's on third. So what used to be in the sole province of doctors now is becoming taken up by physician extenders and nurses. So a lot of conflict between care providers about who does what.
The challenges seem like they impact not just patients versus the system, but there are conflicts within the system itself.
One of the phenomena that we observe is what we call the shadow effect. So if there's a conflict in a policy, that conflict is like a shadow that grows bigger and bigger the farther away from the source you are. So it's true that some of these conflicts, built-in conflicts, regarding reimbursement for care, and this, of course, could be reimbursement for a particular patient care incident, or conflicts about who does what, or conflicts between hospitals and clinics, between inpatient care and outpatient care, certainly once they leave Washington, can result in tremendous disputes across the system. Those disputes can have the effect of complicating the course of patient care, complicating the business of care, and complicate the provision of care by professionals. So, yeah, disputes are very much a part of the system and don't get the attention they deserve often.
Well, and how much of the problem lies in the fact that the disputes are often between parties who aren't necessarily in a position to fix the system? That is, if Washington is making these decisions and you get a dispute between a hospital and a clinic, neither one of them is in the position to change the policy.
Yeah, there are two things that need to happen. First, it's important for those at the front end to understand why they're having the conflict. And sometimes, you're right, it's not about them. It's also important for the system to understand what those conflicts are and create a loop back. So if, in fact, there are conflicts regarding Medicare patients being held in hospitals and not admitted, that information needs to get back to Washington. And Washington policymakers and regulators must look at the implications of those conflicts within the field and then create those changes.
Well, and so what are the implications in terms of the dispute resolution process for the two parties who might be able to communicate to Washington, but in the meantime, they have to come to a resolution that is, if not beloved by both parties, at least both parties are willing to accept it?
Well, credit to Marquette University and the dispute resolution program here. That's raising the awareness of several things. First off, you've got to pay attention to these disputes. They're there. They're getting in the way of care. They're costing money. They're reducing the efficiencies of the system. Then there need to be very concrete mechanisms put in place where people can go to resolve those disputes. One example seen in hospitals here in Wisconsin, patient navigators, people who will be alongside someone who's suffering from cancer and then walk them through the system, because there will be a lot of pushback, obstacles, and disputes that can arise. So part of the responsibility is just acknowledging that these disputes exist and figuring out what to do about them.
This is obviously affecting patient satisfaction. Do you see, is it also affecting professional satisfaction among people in the healthcare field? I mean, I would imagine that doctors aren't going into medicine because they're enthusiastic about the idea of having conflicts with their patients or conflicts with insurance or conflicts with the Medicare system.
You know, I have the opportunity to teach many physicians about negotiation and conflict resolution, many of them well along in their career. And these are people who have extraordinary technical skills. They're great doctors. And they'll come up after a seminar and say, you know, nobody told me that I was supposed to be paying attention to disputes. This is an important part of my practice.
Well, and this is about more than bedside manner, right?
It's far more than bedside manner. And if you see the interaction between a patient or a nurse or caregiver as a negotiation with the patient, it completely reframes the whole question of compliance, because the patient is coming to you for your expertise. You're providing some recommendations. We're trying to negotiate a solution that works for you. So when the caregiver starts seeing this as a negotiation rather than doctor's orders, it completely reframes the interaction.
Does the patient need to look at the interaction in that way as well? I mean, does the patient have to go into it thinking that it's a negotiation, or is it just sort of a natural function of what the patient is getting out of this interaction?
Patients are very different today than they were 20 years ago because of the internet. So it used to be in the good old days that the physicians and the nurses and the caregivers had the knowledge, and patients came in doing whatever they were told to do. Now, many patients come in very well aware of their condition, the treatment options, what needs to be done. So therefore, it becomes a real negotiation between an expert and someone concerned about their care who's bringing in a lot of good questions. The caregiver needs to see that as a negotiation and that we're trying to increase the understanding and then come to a set of decisions that are mutually beneficial.
There are a lot of unknowns about the Affordable Care Act, or they're knowns, but many people don't know them. Do you see any positives within the Affordable Care Act for the field of dispute resolution?
Well, there is not a lot known about it nationally, but we know a lot about it in Massachusetts because the Affordable Care Act was actually modeled on our experience in Massachusetts. Our governor at the time was Mitt Romney, later became presidential candidate. And so many of the people who developed the system in Massachusetts went down to Washington to help construct that system. So the Affordable Care Act is a lot about insurance. And basically, it requires everyone to buy insurance. And with that, there's more the pool of money available to pay for health care is greater. And then there are exchanges that are set up that gets people the opportunity to be insured. In its most simple form, that's what Obamacare is all about. Now, because caregivers have to be very concerned about insurance, because that's how they're paid, there will be implications on the system. But I think we should be really clear, this is really insurance reform more than healthcare reform.
Well, and so then this is going to seem like a flip question, but I always make it a point to read the last line of everyone's bio. Mm-hmm. And yours mentions that you are also a cartoonist.
Mm-hmm. It's actually, being a cartoonist means that you don't draw every cartoon. And there are, in life, a lot of odd things that we see that seem to be contradictions, and that really is the essence of humor. And in fact, I've always seen my work in conflict resolution finding those contradictions and then helping people find ways to resolve them. You know, no better a set of contradictions recently than what we've seen in Washington, where, just as one exemplar, Obamacare isn't really that big a problem for the Republicans, and yet they made it their flag. And, you know, I think if you were to ask them, in very concrete terms, what don't you like, they couldn't really point to exactly what they don't like because it hasn't happened yet. So what they don't like is what could happen, not what is happening. And I don't think they understand the bill. So I found, as I've been reading through the news and watching this play out, and I think a lot of people are the same sense, just a lot of cartoons, not all of which I've actually drawn, but periodically I do.
You found it a way to kind of process the world.
The world is full of conflict. And, you know, I think that's one of the contributions that the field can make. The world is full of conflict. We humans are generally not good at resolving it because, and there's a bit of neuroscience in this, we call it going to the basement. When we are threatened in any way, and a conflict oftentimes has some element of threat, there's a structure in our brain called the amygdala, and it lights up, and it turns on our reptilian brain, and that takes over all of our thinking functions. In our nomenclature, we call that going to the basement. The basement is you're in that reptilian brain function. And when you're there, you can only see a very limited set of options. Triple F. It's either freeze, and many people do, or flight, you run away, or fight, you become very aggressive. And there are many of things in our daily life that can take us to the basement. Certainly if you're a parent, kids were designed to take us to the basement. A nasty email from a colleague can take you to the basement. And certainly, if you're in the middle of a conflict or if you're in the middle of a crisis, there are many things that will take you to the basement. You know, one of the things that we teach is never negotiate, make major life decisions, or lead when you're in the basement. And it's critical, and this really goes to the whole body of work that's developing in neuroscience. It's important to get yourself out of the basement. It's tough. And what we say is you need to reset your brain. Do something routine. Count to two or three or four. Do something you've practiced. You know, put something in your mind that you're going to do when you're in the basement. So first, admit you're in the basement. Get yourself out of the basement so that you can get a clear sense of what's going, or basically reassume control of your brain. And once you're out of the basement, you can go to that higher level thinking and say, here's what's going on. Here's what we're doing. There's a gap. How do we close that gap? And that's a critical skill for conflict resolution, critical skill for life, and a critical skill for getting through a crisis. And when people say, well, what's the relationship between your work in crisis leadership and healthcare conflict resolution? There's a lot of overlap. Doctors and nurses and patients have a lot that can take them to the basement. Crisis leaders have a lot that can take them to the basement. And to the extent that leaders can recognize that first in themselves, leaders can recognize that in other people, help folks get out of the basement, and then direct them towards constructive activity. Certainly it works in healthcare, and certainly it works in crisis scenarios as well.
Dr. Leonard Marcus, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Leonard Marcus is a Milwaukee native who now directs the Program for Healthcare Negotiation and Conflict Resolution at the Harvard School of Public Health. He was back in Milwaukee to deliver the keynote address at the Dispute Resolution and Healthcare Conference held by Marquette University's Graduate Program in Dispute Resolution. Keep listening. Thousands of people pass an old car in a Wauwatosa parking lot each day, but Milwaukee Magazine's Kurt Chandler actually stopped to learn the story of the car and its owner. He shares it with us when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. If you spent any time at the municipal complex in Wauwatosa, you've probably noticed a car that looks the slightest bit out of place in the parking lot. Alongside the minivans and hybrids of suburbia, a blue and rusty 1961 Ford Falcon is frequently parked behind the public library. The story of that car, or more to the point, the story of its owner, is outlined in an essay by Milwaukee Magazine editor Kurt Chandler in the current issue. It's a story that spurred an outpouring of interest from readers, and Kurt Chandler joins us now to talk about it. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mitch. It's always good to be here. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. What first got you thinking about this distinctive Ford Falcon and its owner?
Well, I live in Wauwatosa, not too far from the Wauwatosa Public Library, and I make quite a few trips over to the library for books, for CDs, for movies. It's a great place. I love libraries, love public libraries. And I'd noticed this old rusty Ford Falcon sitting in the parking lot all the time. I mean, virtually every time I went there, this car was parked in the lot. And I thought, well, okay, maybe there's an employee there who drives this thing. One day, I noticed somebody sitting in the driver's seat. So my curiosity got the better of me, and I walked up and tapped on the door, and I started a conversation with this man sitting in the driver's seat. He was smoking a cigarette and listening to the radio, and it turns out his name is John, and he does not work for the public library. He is homeless and has been for the past 7 years and living in his car, 1961 Ford Falcon. It was filled with clothes and water bottles and a few tools. And so I asked him if I could talk to him and hear what his story was. I identified myself as a reporter with Milwaukee Magazine. And he was hesitant at first, but he told me about his life being homeless. It was quite a story, and I decided to write about it.
So you say he was hesitant at first, but in the end opened up a bit.
Yeah, he didn't want his last name published. And I thought, well, okay, everybody's got a few skeletons in the closet. I don't know if I was approached by a reporter, if I would even talk to the reporter, knowing some of the tricks that us reporters have in our pockets. But he was open about talking about his family or lack of family. He does not have relatives in the area. And about his daily routine, he finally, you know, talked to me about where he sleeps. He sleeps in his car. He parks in a cemetery because it's quiet and relatively safe. The owner of this cemetery is grateful to have him parked there because it keeps the vandals and hoodlums away, seeing that there's a car in the lot. But he is of very poor health. He has asthma, emphysema, and he was in the hospital a couple years ago with double pneumonia. And just a couple weeks after I met him, he was admitted to the emergency room with a collapsed lung. So he is only 56, but in fairly poor health.
Have you heard reaction from readers? And has he heard reaction? Because you are obviously not the only one that sees this car on a frequent basis. I mean, as I was coming to work this morning, I saw his car drive by me.
I talked to the librarian at Wauwatosa Library, who actually is a friend, and she says, yes, she was aware of him. And once he got into an argument with somebody in the parking lot, some woman apparently opened her car door into his car, and he took offense at that. You know, he said, well, you know, this is my property. No matter what it looks like, don't abuse my property. And he got into a verbal argument. The librarian had to call the police. They calmed him down. But generally, he's just a citizen using the public library. He goes in, reads books, surfs the internet. I got a quite a few voicemails and letters, email from a Wauwatosa City employee who said, oh, we've always been wondering about that guy and what he was doing there, whether he was safe, whether we were safe from him. And she said, thanks for clearing up the mystery. I also got a very interesting letter handwritten from a woman who lives in West Dallas who also has sought government assistance because she, you know, only has a part-time job as a crossing guard and some health issues as well. She was telling me how she survives on a limited federal assistance, Social Security check every month. But she wanted to pass along some information, some advice to John, along with a coat that she had, a winter coat for him. So she didn't have a computer. John doesn't have a telephone. So I communicated with her by phone and John by email and was the middleman here. And I put the two of them together and they met. The coat was far too big for John and he had to pass on the coat, but she gave him a nice pair of winter gloves and some advice on how to get food stamps, housing assistance, a cheap or free cell phone, you know, one of those disposable phones, and things like this. And I was really struck by her generosity. And I wrote a blog about it, but I thought that, you know, this is a really nice thing for somebody to do, and shouldn't everybody be this generous and kind? She did not want her name used either. She just wanted to be an anonymous Good Samaritan, I guess. And John was very happy to receive her advice. John himself has made some changes since this ran in the magazine. He's quit smoking. He had been a real heavy smoker. And he also got a bad leak in his car fixed from a friend who is a mechanic. So he's trying to turn things around. He's trying to see what he can do now to find a place to live with some assistance.
Well, and one of the things that really strikes me about this essay is that It doesn't come to any particular conclusion. It just lays out the facts of John's life.
Right. I wasn't going to try to moralize or try to get into a political commentary about federal aid or state aid or city aid. I was struck, though, by how different his reality is from mine. There's not that much that separates people from ending up in the same situation that John is in. I have a nice car. I went home that day after talking to him and I had a nice lunch and I live in a comfortable home. And it was miles away from his existence, you know, sleeping in his car every night, eating as frugally as possible. But that has been his existence for so long. I'm just wondering how difficult it will be for him to make changes, really, and adjust his routine because he has one. He was in the hospital, as I said before, after his lung collapsed, and he called me because he was having a very difficult time in the hospital. It was uncomfortable for him. The doctors were not the most kind to him, according to John, and he wasn't sleeping. So finally, he checked himself out of the hospital, went back to his car, and got a great night's sleep, sleeping in the front seat of his car after being in the hospital for 3 days.
Do you think – is there something emblematic in this kind of story as it pertains to what you try to accomplish as a journalist? You're in this new position, relatively new position, last couple of months as editor of the magazine. Obviously, all the stories aren't going to be about a guy in a car someplace. But does it speak to something that you really try to accomplish?
I've always thought that if people can meet another human being – and talk and communicate and relate on some level to that human being, whether that person is of the opposite party, of a different race or ethnicity, of a different income level, sexual orientation, they can get along on just a human level. And I've seen this again and again and again in sort of the issue-related stories I've written and edited as a journalist. Whether it's profiling gays or lesbians or people in John's situation, I think that somewhere in us as human beings, we can just strip away all the labels and all the differences and at our best see what we share. And I think that is what I came away with this essay. And I think time and time again, I hear that on stories that try to get at that very human level where there might be an issue. I think that can be secondary and maybe dismissed. I'm not sure if Congress would agree with that, but I think most people would.
You'd been away from Milwaukee Magazine for a while before they called you back and hired you as the editor. You'd served kind of temporarily in that role in times past, but what makes this the right job for you at this time in your life?
Well, the timing just seemed very right. I've always seen myself as a writer at heart and was loath to be pulled into an editor's position. I had done it temporarily at Milwaukee Magazine and really enjoyed getting back to writing. This time, I had just finished up with a couple book projects I was working on. I was scouting around for my next idea, probably another book idea. I was doing some freelancing, including some articles for Milwaukee Magazine. And the call came out of the blue, and I thought about it, and I talked to people, and I slept on it. And then I started waking up in the morning after a day or two thinking about story ideas that I would assign to writers and people who I would bring into the magazine and how I might reshape the magazine. And I thought, you know, this could be fun. This could be fun. And there's always that thing in the back of your mind that asks, well, what if you don't do this? Then you're going to wonder what if for the rest of your life. So I jumped in, and so far, so good. I'm working with a very young, talented, creative, enthusiastic staff. I'm getting a lot of support so far, and who knows? Maybe I won't last. Maybe I'll be booted out sooner than I think, but I can always go back to doing what I was or doing something completely different. I feel like I have a sort of an open slate here, and teamed up with Linda Lundin, who's now the publisher of Milwaukee Magazine. I think there's sort of a new opportunity for a new direction and good stuff to come.
Well, we're looking forward to reading it. Kurt Chandler, thanks so much.
Thanks, Mitch.
Kurt Chandler is editor at Milwaukee Magazine. You can find a link to his essay called Running on Empty from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Next on the program, an update on a project called Legacy Letters, which we first introduced to you some time ago. Keep listening. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. A few years ago on the show, we spoke with Shorewood writer Leah Dobkin about a new business she was launching called Legacy Letters. She would help people write the stories of their lives and channel their collected wisdom and values into one heartful and comprehensive letter to be passed down to future generations. Dobkin knew most people needed direction and guidance as they took stock of their lives, as they considered their legacies and even their mortality. Little did Dobkin know when she started the project that she'd have to confront the same questions her clients were facing. Leah Dobkin tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce about the turn her project took.
Well, it's been a bizarre ride, for sure. When I met you and talked about Legacy Letters, a few weeks later I was diagnosed with cancer and put everything on hold, and everything we talked about and all the workshops and I put on hold until I went through chemo and gained my strength and energy back. And the very first workshop I did about helping people write legacy letters was actually at Freidert. They sponsored a workshop for fellow cancer patients and survivors. And I've been doing that on and off the last 2 years or so. Actually, another one is coming up in September. Once I gained my strength back, my last chemo was September 15th, 2011. And I started back again, trying to get this effort off the ground and to help people write legacy letters. And so that was going very well, and it's just been an amazing journey.
Then you were hit with another tragedy.
Yes. A little bit over 5 months later from my last chemo, my daughter died, my 19-year-old daughter, Hannah Rose. And so I've been dealing with that. I've been knocked down around a bit, but I'm still standing on my feet. And it gives me more motivation and a sense of urgency to help people write their legacy letters now because of this. I wrote my daughter a legacy letter before I was diagnosed. At the time, I just assumed, oh, I would die before she. And so in a million years, I never expected that she would go before me. And so I was really glad that I did write the legacy letter to her. But now I have this new sense of urgency about that everybody should do it yesterday, you know, kind of thing. The other thing is that I've been struggling with trying to figure out ways of honoring her life and making sure that her life wasn't in vain. And so over the last 2 years or so, as the legacy letters has been evolving, I've been developing specialty letters. And as a result of my daughter's death, I decided to offer Honor Your Angel legacy letters, where parents or grandparents or siblings or other loved ones can write a letter about their loved one who is deceased, about their lives and their stories and what made them special. Because one thing that's happened to me in the last, you know, year and a half and 5 days since Hannah died is that people feel uncomfortable talking about her. And what I want to do is talk about her. I want to hear her name out loud. I want to make sure she's not forgotten. I want to make sure that not only that I keep the memories alive, but that people around me remember her. And people feel uncomfortable not only bringing up her name, but what I really want is to share stories. I want to share my stories about her. It would be such a gift for people that I love, my friends and family, to share stories about her. And there's some general reluctance about that. And so I realized other parents must be going through this too. I bet they have the strong need to want to share stories about their loved ones. And so that's why I developed Honor Your Angel Legacy Letters, to help people develop these letters about their loved ones that have deceased way too early.
How does the approach differ between the traditional legacy letters, where you're kind of thinking about your own life and the sum of its parts, whereas with these, you're thinking of someone you've loved and the life that they led? How do you guide people in terms of where to begin?
Right. Well, you use more tissues. That's for one thing. I always bring a box of tissues. For Honor Your Angel legacy letters, what you do is you capture people's stories about that person. How do they inspire you? What do you admire most about them? What are some stories that illustrate why they're so special? And how did they impact you? what would it be like if they never were on the earth in the first place? What's the difference did they make on you and your family and friends and on the world? I mean, my daughter, she volunteered at Discovery World. She wanted to be an oceanographer. And when she was little, she used to train goldfish to do flips at home. And first she wanted to be a dolphin trainer, and then eventually she wanted to be an oceanographer. And so, you know, I want to talk about stories about her related to that, you know, about her love of animals, how wherever she would go, butterflies would land on her. And she had this propensity to relate to animals. And so I want to talk about that, for example. So in my legacy letter to her, it would be about her love of animals and how that was expressed.
Is there an appropriate point in the grieving process where beginning this Honor Your Angel legacy letter project is appropriate to begin?
I would say that the word appropriate should never be used.
Apologies.
No, that's okay, because it's grief is not understood well. No one understands grief well. We don't do well with grief here in our culture. And every person's experience is so unique that what's appropriate for someone may not be appropriate for someone else. So, for example, one thing that's helped me the last year and a half is, I just wrote a lot of poetry and just put pen to paper. I'm a writer, and it just seemed like a natural outlet where I wrote a lot of poetry about her. Someone else may feel compelled right away to write. Other people may feel like they need to digest everything and wait a year or two until they get more of a perspective. What people often don't realize that the first year, you're kind of in shock. You're numb. You're frozen. You're walking, but you're not living. You're not part of the people who are alive. You just, even though you look alive and see, talk and walk, you don't feel alive. But then in the second year, you generally start numbing and you start feeling things more, but the support isn't there. So very often the second year is more difficult. So I could imagine for parents and grandparents that when the wonderful support you received the first year dissipates, that perhaps maybe the second year you would have a stronger need to write a letter just to keep that person's memory alive and make sure that they have a legacy and that you articulate it. So I just think that it can really vary. The other point I wanted to point out is grieving never ends. It doesn't go through stages like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, you know, pioneered death and dying stages. It never ends. In fact, when I was driving relatives to the airport after Hannah's memorial, there was a volunteer, and she was talking to my mother. And my mother told me that she had lost her son, you know, over 50 years ago, and there's not a morning that she doesn't wake up and think about him. And so we don't realize that grief is with us. We can't bypass it. We just have to learn to work through it.
You began this Legacy Letters project before your daughter died, as you mentioned. Did any of what you learned in creating the project to begin with help you in your own grief journey?
That's really an interesting question. I have been so blessed by interviewing my clients and collecting their pearls of wisdom that I realize, as a side benefit, that they have provided extra clarity in my life and extra perspective. And through the process of helping people write their legacy letter, I help people get to a perspective which I call the eternity perspective. What is the earth like without you in it? And when you get that perspective, all the little squabbles and conflicts in your life seem so minimal. And that's why I think writing a legacy letter is so healing, because you have a different kind of perspective. And so because I helped other people get that eternity perspective, when Hannah Rose died, I think I could put it in better perspective as well. And so, yes, I never even thought of that. But, yeah, it really did help me. And the legacy letter work that I do is sacred. and it's very spiritual. And so it also provided some strength, I think, to deal with her death.
What do you think Hannah Rose would say about you continuing and persevering with this project?
Right on, Mom. That's what she probably would say. She was very proud. I had a book reading at the downtown public library about the Soul of a Port, that book that I had written. And, you know, I had cancer and I put all my speaking engagements on hold. This was the first time I was coming back to do it. She came to that event and I was so thrilled because she helped me sell books and she was engaged in the whole process. Usually you want to give a sense of pride to your children, but sometimes as they grow up and they're older, it's nice to have it reciprocated. And after she died, I found her journal. And the last page of her journal was critiquing my my book reading. And she said such funny things. She said, "Ma, that was a great introduction." But she also said, because I had my favorite photographs in the book, and so as I would talk about stories of people down at the port, I shared my photographs and I had captions. And she says, "Well, remember when you have a caption, some of your captions didn't have a period at the end of the sentence." So she was that observant and that engaged, and she's just an amazing young woman.
What do you hope to be giving grieving parents, grandparents, grieving loved ones like yourself through these legacy letters?
The privilege to talk about the person and to share those stories is number one, because I think it's a vehicle to help with healing. I think it also may open up a different perspective once they reflect on their lives and their lives with that loved one who deceased. So I think it may gain some clarity, some humor to lighten the load a little bit. And I think most important, I think it would be something that would be cathartic for the person to finally be able to put words to paper and really express in a way that would feel comfortable to that person, their love for that person, to in essence to say, you know, if you're paying attention to what I'm doing, this is for you too, and I just want you to know, if I didn't tell you how much I loved you when you were alive, this gives me another opportunity.
Well, Leah Dobkin, thank you so much for telling us about Honor Your Angel Legacy Letters and for telling us a little bit about Hannah Rose.
You're welcome.
Shorewood writer Leah Dobkin is the founder of Legacy Letters. There's a link to more information, including details about her next writing circle, for which the registration deadline is fast approaching, from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce in an interview which first aired last month. That's Lake Effect for Tuesday, October 22nd. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, we're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.